guest speaker for the night.
Line up, Dennis.
Hey, everybody, I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Jim. Don't worry, Glenn, I'll get a grip on this. Sit down, relax. I'll get some of these butterflies out of the way, and then hopefully I'll tell you my story. But first, I want to thank the committee, the convention committee, gentlemen, and John Francis Mack back there, who I met down in Philadelphia. And I don't know why, I started this convention back in 92, and feeling honored to be asked to come back somewhere. That's not easier for us out there. You don't get invited back from there, you know? But I guess the program works, and if you stay stable, anything can happen. And this is the 50th anniversary of the Hudson Mohawk Berkshire Convention, which is that's outstanding, you know. And the program started in 1935, and you started having conventions in 1950. That's pretty cool. Feels good that we had to learn how to celebrate life in sobriety, and I've been trying to do that since I came to the program, and these conventions help us do it, you know. You look around the room and see how sharp you look, and you get our little suits on. Who would think we were a bunch of gents at one time, you know? And it had to be. And I was down with John and Charlie and Ed, who were like, you know, these guys were over 40 years sobriety down in Ocean City. Ocean City, Philadelphia Institute had their convention in Ocean City, New Jersey. That's how AA works. They had to go to Jersey to have their convention. And we had Irish potatoes, these candies that I never heard of. I thought I heard of everything Irish, but we were eating these Irish potatoes and having a good old time. And, you know, I was listening to where this program came from, and sometimes when I get nervous about where we're going, I just listen to where we've been. And then the nervousness goes out of me. You know, I know that we're going to be okay in LA. I've done all the same things that happened tonight. And John, you know, you say the preamble 10,000 times in your head, and you've said it, and then you get up in front of the mic, and you don't have it written in front of you, and you go dry. That's what's great about LA. Anything can happen here, and it's just okay. We took John to dinner last night down at the pen, and my wife knocked a big glass of water over on his pants. And it's just typical stuff. He said, you know, I go to hundreds of conventions, this is the first time I only brought one pair of pants. I love this stuff, you know? So every convention is an adventure, you know? Something cool happens at everyone that I go to. And I want to thank Laura for sharing her experience, strength, and hope with us. And, you know, you only have to go to 6 meetings in an hour. You got to do 99, right? I should have started there. 6 meetings in a row, that wouldn't have scared me so much. 90, my God. So my wife's over there at that table, and she hasn't done 6 in a row yet, so we got some kids stuck there. So I don't know where. Raise your hand, I mean. I let go, I'm letting go, I'm letting die. I'm working on it. Well, I had the privilege of being at the 50th anniversary of AA up in Montreal with my wife, and for the best of my recollection, that was the first time that I cried in front of my wife, you know. Lois Wilson got up to that stage, you know, the first lady of Al-Anon, and this little tiny woman, about, I don't know, she's probably 85 pounds soaking wet, you know, she got up to the mic, and I expected, you know, to hear this poor little voice, you know, and this powerful voice come out of her, you know, and she said how proud, you know, they would have been to have seen so many of us there, because I think that was, like, you know, another record numbers at the convention, and you know, you could feel the love coming out of her, you know, love and service. So, you know, I've had so many privileges in this program, and basically, and the jump from the balance sheet, you know, should have been dead a long time ago, like most of us in this room. I'm really nervous because I'm not back from the balance where it's safe. But we're up here in beautiful downtown Poughkeepsie, I guess we're in. And we're at the not so regular open AA meeting of the Hudson Mohawk Berkshire Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's pretty cool. We're the only area in New York that doesn't have, you know, like senior, Southeast New York, and you got Central New York, Western New York. You guys are cool. You got Hudson Mohawk Boats here. HMB. I like that. The Google. Coming from the Bronx, that's important, that kind of stuff. We pay attention to the most ridiculous little things, trivial stuff. But again, it's an honor to be here tonight, and I try to get the better side of the day away by, when we start laughing, I start feeling a little more comfortable, you know? Because today I know that we're laughing with each other, not at each other, and that's pretty cool. So I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and in a general way. So I'll try to do that. I'm had a lot of identification with Laura. I'm from a long line of alcoholics, drunk sliders, classic drunk. My father's whole family pretty much was wiped out by this disease, to the best of my knowledge. There's one brother we just don't know about. He's just missing in action. I haven't been able to get any information about him. And my mother had three N's. You know, she had a man, a nurse, and a nut. I had my two older sisters, and there was 5 years between us. So I was the baby and the nut. You know, like I couldn't get up in the South Bronx, 138th Street, St. Louis Parish, and somebody from St. Louis. I think all life started in the Bronx. You know that? I've never gone anywhere in my life where I haven't met somebody that if they weren't from the Bronx, oh, my Uncle Harry, my Aunt Mary, and everything started right in the Bronx, I think. But I grew up there, and I remember two basic feelings my whole life. It was fear and anger. You know, I think I was born afraid, and then when you get up in the South Bronx, you're not allowed to tell anybody that you're afraid. So I got angry about that. And that just followed me around until I was able to pick up a drink and try to make what I was doing go away, like most of us did. My first going out drinking experience that I recall was we were going to speak into the rafts, and then you got your friends, and you hung outside a delicatessen or the bodega, and you waited for an older, thirsty-looking person to come by, you know, and you offered to buy them a quart of beer if they bought the beer for you. And somebody would always put the bill and buy it for you. And then you would sneak it with something for the ranch, and this was the first time, I had moved, by the way, from 138th Street. I told my friends when I was 8 years old, we moved upstate. We moved 8 miles up the road to Gainesville Projects. So yeah, we went from one of those old fashioned tenement buildings to the projects, and we had grass, the kitchens, and then you weren't allowed to walk on it. So it's like a big room to me. And so we were stuck into the last one for the high winds, to hide out. And, you know, I was fascinated with drinking. I grew up, sitting on the bar stools with my father, watching him do the Boilermakers. Somebody at a meeting this morning was saying how they drank Boilermakers. My father drank, at the old times meeting. My father drank Season 7 and beer chases. And I would get my little cherry cokes, you know, and when he started getting drunk, I would get the dimes for the bowling machine, you know. So I knew how to hang out in the bar. And, by this time, I wasn't too crazy about my father either, as I got older, because he's drinking progressed, and, you know, things get crazy. So as I'm going to go with the guys to be cool, I got my quarter Colt 45. We got Colt 45 because white liquor supposedly got you high faster. You also, you shake your ashes into the beer because that was supposed to get you high quicker. No one's ever scientifically proved that to me, but we did it anyway. So the interesting thing was, you know, I took that first quart, and I was with Gary and Glenn and Robert, and I snuck over in the rooms, and I spilled some out. Because there's much, and they call that grass in it. And as much as I wanted to drink that quart of beer, I was afraid. So I mean, right from my first drinking experience, I had a dilemma with alcohol. You know, I wasn't social drinking, you know? And I got drunk, and we went to St. Raymond's High School dance, and evidently in the bathroom, somebody had, what's that 100 proof, Southern Comfort. Yeah, I knew somebody was there. They had a bottle of Southern Comfort, and I started having a little of that in there, and evidently I had my first blackout on my first night. And but that knot that was in my stomach from birth, I guess, we unwound, you know. I went from Mickey Mouse to Mighty Mouse. And for the first time in my life, I was like, you know, the whole thing, everybody, the feeling that everybody talked about, you know, the burning sensation first, but then, like, you know, I'm in heaven. And I don't remember much about the rest of the night. Evidently, I was kicked out of the dance. But my friends told me how much fun I was and how funny I was. And that was it. For the rest of my life, I chased that. Unbeknownst to me, for the rest of my life, alcohol was going to make, up until sobriety, of course, alcohol was going to make all the decisions in my life that normal people make on their own. And everything was to be, you know, cool, to be accepted. That's why I started smoking cigarettes in, I guess, the fourth grade. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so, you know, obviously I did a lot of other drugs, and I won't bore you with that because I have a lot of respect for this fellowship. I've been involved in service for a long time, and I know that's one of its purpose. But you need to know that I stay out of drugs, too. Basically, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I've met drug addicts who can't drink alcohol. You know, there is a subtle difference between us. I know what I am. I'm a drunk who did drugs because drugs were on the scene at that time. As a matter of fact, I smoked tons of marijuana. I got two feelings. I got paranoid and tired. You know? Every time. And, you know, you think you would stop. You know, don't smoke it. I never had a good feeling from it. And I would go, you know, I'd be going around the room and I'd see it coming and go, oh, no, no. I don't want to. And then I'd go, what are you looking at? What's the matter with you? You know. So then I would use more to make that feeling go away. So all the drugs I did like speed and ups, it all enabled me to drink more. It enabled me to fit in more. The drug crew that I hung around with in Crescent Point in the Bronx as I was growing up, they started shooting dope. And I was afraid of needles. My sister Pat became a nurse, and when she went to Bellevue Nursing School, and she was, you know, they were teaching them how to use syringes. And she told me how if you get a air pocket in there, you could kill somebody. So I wasn't afraid of heroin, but I was afraid of killing myself with the needle. So I left that group. I was right around when I became 18. I left that group and I went up to my friend John. We went from, I guess I went another 6 miles up in the Bronx, more upstate. I went from Crescent Point to the Frog's Neck area, and disco was just becoming big now. The disco area was in. And my friend John's brother-in-law was opening a hollow leg discotheque. What a place. So then, in passing on, when Jay Wilson talked about getting to Wall Street, he said he had arrived. Well, when I got behind the bar in the hollow leg discotheque in 1971, I had arrived. Uh-huh. See, I was at home in the bar. In that drug world that I was in, I was always uncomfortable and felt out of place, and, you know, it just wasn't me. But then I got in the bar, I grew up in the bar, you know. Now I'm telling my friends how to act, you know. Order a hard-boiled bag, leave your money on the bar, you know, like that was really cool. So, I started in the courtroom, and then I graduated to the back bar. No, I started in the courtroom, then I served hot dogs, because you have to serve food in the discotheque, when you lose your license. Then I got to work in the back bar, and then it was one of the longest bars in the Bronx. And there were 3 bartenders behind the main bar, and the place was packed. And I got behind the main bar, you know, I was like in heaven. Stands every night, that's why I can't hear now, I'm going back from those days. But I mean, I was in heaven, I was like 19 years old, and I was hanging out with guys 25, 26, that we had houses in the Hamptons, you know, you put each guy gets $500 together, and now it's probably like $10,000 together to get a house in the Hamptons now, but back in the 70s, $500 a head, and you had a place for the summer, and you know, my mother was really upset about my drinking. My father had left by this time. My mother followed the Irish Catholic law, wait till the kids are grown, then took the bum out. When everybody was all messed up. She was on my case, you know, like I'm 19 years old, I'm making a whole bunch of money, and you know, at that time we got paid $15 for bartending. And if you came in early, you started at 9, But if you come into church and set the place up and put the floor dust on the floor, you got an extra $5, you got $20 a night. But the tips were incredible in those days, you know. A 19-year-old kid, I was making $100 a night in tips and spending it in the Hamptons before I could get home. And my mother was upset about this. I couldn't understand this woman, you know. She told me to get a good job. I said, I got a great job. But, you know, I just have to get this good, you know, because I felt very guilty, and the phone company went on strike in 1971. I went on strike for 7 months, and all the guys were drinking in the bar with me. Because I worked days, evenings, and nights at the bar. You know, I lived there practically. So the phone guys were coming in after picket duty, and they said, why don't you go down and get the job? So again, I didn't say one day, oh, communications, what a great career. You know, it was like, I get my mother off my back. I went to a 1775 Grand Concourse for a branch headquarters of the phone company at that time, and they hired me on the spot. They said, will you work during the strike? I said, of course I'll work during the strike. I'm here, aren't I? I signed all the papers, and then I went on strike. Look at the guy. So I went home, and I told my mother, I got a good job, Mom. We're on strike. I was back in the bar, just what I wanted to be. Well, first I went to school for 4 weeks, of course. You know, they had to train me to how to fix telephones. So I went to school, you know, took 4 weeks pay, and then I went on strike. Because the guys in the bar told me that it was okay to do that. And I went on strike, and then the strike ended, and I actually had to go work for this company. I wasn't following these steps through at the time, you know what I mean? It was just a good idea at the time. But, you know, good things happen to us in spite of ourselves, you know. This month I celebrate 30 years in the telephone company, which is like, unbelievable. And before you say it, I know I'm employed by the phone company. Nobody works. So, people say, you work for the phone company? Come on, nobody works. But actually, when I got saved, I actually did some work for the phone company. So now I guess I'm getting around 21, and all the guys are getting married. So I took the required 5 minutes for an alcoholic to fall in love, and I got married. And I married Jean in 1973, and I was divorced in 1977. It took my father 26 years to get kicked out of his house, and I did it in 4.5 years. And I attribute the speed of that process to the drugs that I took. See, I'm grateful for those drugs because I think it got me to AA probably 20 years sooner maybe than if I didn't do them. So in a bizarre way, I'm grateful for drugs. But I destroyed that marriage, and my life was going downhill very rapidly. And I went on a 2.5 year binge of the craziest drinking and drugging you could do when I got divorced. Because see, you know, we always have those little crossroads that make us not alcoholics, you know, like I don't drink in the morning, or and all of those things are going away, you know, like I had no more excuses. I was just like my father, and I hated myself. And I was divorced, and that's the only time I got into that, like, depressed kind of drinking. Mostly I was a bar fly, you know, I hung around the bars and bartended all through my phone career. But I got, for like maybe 3 or 4 months, I was into that really. She left, I had one of those table wheels from the phone company as my coffee table. You know, those small ones, I put some ceramic tiles on the top and a little rope around the end to make it look really fancy. And I had a little homemade bar, I had a couch, a stereo, and a TV, and a mattress in the bedroom. Really fancy, you know, big telephone union guy with my fancy shoulder pad. And I was like drinking beer scotch out of the glass and snorting cocaine out of the grout in the tiles of that beautiful little coffee table. And I would play the records on the stereo in the order that they devastate me the worst. Put the wedding song on top so it would play last. And then get into that real big, and then go in the mirror in the bathroom to see how bad you look, you know. Sobbing, it was great. I loved it. I don't want you to feel sorry for me, because I can feel sorry for me better than you could. It was really incredible. When you look back, you were a sick cat. Well, I was a sick cat. I can't take your inventory. I was a very sick cat. Well, I know some of you are sick cats too. You told me. I was really a mess, and I started getting really frightened. This is the time when you start thinking, like, I was seriously thinking that, like, maybe I'm mentally retarded. And you know how, like big companies have to hire, you know, the physically sound and mentally sound people? I'm telling you, I started thinking that, like, they just never tell me that I'm one of those people, but I'm nuts, because nothing was making any sense anymore, and I desperately didn't want to be an alcoholic or a drug addict, so I'm nuts. And I got arrested. There were things that were never going to happen to a nice little Irish Catholic kid like me. And it was scary, because my brother-in-law was a city cop, and I had his little badge with his number on it, and that got me out of an incredible amount of jams. All the drunk and driving tickets I should have got, that little badge saved me. In those days, as you probably remember, you could walk a lot easier than you could now. God got me sober right at the right time when they really cracked down on drinking and driving. So I got this, I was going through the worst period of my life. Things were really bad. And I got this brilliant idea. I'll get married again. I'll get responsibility back in my life and I'll be good. And I was really believing this stuff, you know. So I took another retired 5 minutes before I left, and I fell in love with Annette, and we got married. And it took 3.5 months to do everything to Annette that it took 4.5 years to do to Gene. So I kind of understand the progression of this disease a little bit. It was pretty scary, you know, like, we were on another strike. I forget what year this, I guess it was 77, something like that. No, it was 80, 1980. We were on strike again for a short time, I had an apartment, so I don't know why this happened, but we wound up in the motel one night, and it was supposed to be a short stay motel, you know, but I woke up to like, I was dreaming about a ringing in my ears, and then I woke up and it was the phone, and it was the guy in the hotel saying, hey, I thought you were only going to be a couple of hours, and it was the next morning, knowing that, I look out the door, no car, no nothing. And it's like, man, what? And you're racking your brain, you know, I'm going to back out, I don't remember anything. And now, we weren't married yet, we were engaged at the time. And I had to, you know, drop a dime. It was only a dime then, the phone. We needed a raise, that's why it's a quarter now. So I picked up. And you know, that feeling, that horrible feeling, I had a call and like, take it, like, what happened? What is that, you know, like, how do I handle this one? And she said, you know, I said, what happened? She said, I don't know if I want to hang out with you anymore. You know, you're insane. And you know, it was bad. It wasn't that bad, but it was bad, you know. And that horrible feeling, you know, that horrible feeling inside of us, just that useless feeling. But she was strong enough to forgive me, and she stuck by me, and she had to put up with all the nonsense that you get on and put up with for a long time. It's amazing to me. So we got married. We married 3 months, and things were getting worse and worse. I felt, you know, I had a good union position with the phone company. I knew if I lost that I would lose the job, and, you know, just everything was spiraling downhill. So that was like a second bottom, like a trap door to the first divorce. And I was really frightened, but that's when the miracle happened for me. My father called me up after I hadn't seen him in about 15, 16 years, I guess, somewhere in there. I ran into him twice in that time, once in a bar and once on the street. And he said, son, I'm having a heart attack. Could you take me to Lincoln Hospital? And he had a lot of heart attacks, but this was evidently a big one. And I guess he got my number out of the phone book because he had the same name, because I don't know how he found me. And I immediately turned into like Eddie Haskell on Leave It to Beaver show, you know? as Laura said, at this point, I mean, inside, and I never told anybody, because, you know, 12 years of Catholic education, you know, you don't tell anybody that you hate your father. That's just the way I grew up. But I hated my father, and I never told anybody that. But, you know, sitting on the phone, heart attack, I went, okay, Dan, I'll be right there. Like, I didn't even like this man, but I turned into this school. I was Catholic here, and the feelings that you go through are amazing. Now I'm like the hero, you know. So I jumped in, this was 1980. I jumped in my 1968 Volkswagen bus, my snappy new car, you know. I had a Volkswagen bus, the camper kind, that looked like a demolition derby mobile, like all my cars. And I called my friend Charlie, and we jumped in my Volkswagen bus, and we stopped at the bodega to pick up an 8-pack of Miller Mips for the ride. Because you don't get on a 3-mile ride without an 8-pack of Miller Mips. Even if your father is having a massive heart attack. Then you haven't seen him in 15 years. So I picked him up, we put him in the back of the van, and I'm driving the van, sucking down a Miller Mip, smoking a cigarette, driving a stick shift, turning around, telling my father how Boone is going to kill him. Because I know this stuff, because I'm driving drunks to rehab, to my union position, because I'm very slick. I hooked up with the EAP for my union so I can know what's going on all the time, and I won't stand out so much. I used to drive guys to rehab telling them, I know what you're going through, pal. I'm a controlled alcoholic myself. Made that up. But that was pretty cool. So they took him to, we took him to Pelham Bay General Hospital, where Annette was a nurse at the time. You know, while we marry nurses, we need to be taken care of. So, my father went right into coronary intensive care, and I guess for the first time in his life, he was really scared. He had other heart attacks, but this was a biggie, and when he came out of intensive care, the counselor from my union offered him a scholarship to a rehab. And at this time in my job, it wasn't 28 days, it was 13 weeks you went away, as many times as you needed to go. Out in Long Island, this is where all the pilots went, and the nurses, and the stewardesses, and the pilots, phone people. It was like a fancy dancy rehab out there. And they said, you know, do you want to go to the family counseling? And I'm at the worst point in my life. So, but I, you know, I wasn't going there, you know, with my hat in my hand. I was always conniving and driving, and I said, I'll go to the family counseling, I'll get a few pointers. And I don't have to admit anything, you know. So I went to the family counseling, and they had that chart. I forget the name of it. They had that chart on alcoholism that shows the progression of alcoholism. Jelinek, the Jelinek chart. And I'm reading it, and I was 28 years old, and I was in the chronic stage of alcoholism, right on the bottom of that chart. What a happy feeling that was. So I remember, like, actually, trembling, sitting in the chair going, oh, man. And I raised my hand, I said, you know, I thought I was coming here to help my father, but I guess I'm an alcoholic. And then I realized where those people were out of their minds, because they started clapping. And I understand why we clap now, but I thought that was bizarre. Coming from the South Bronx with my background and just admitting that you're a drunk, I didn't expect any applause, you know? I wanted to jump up and run out of there. Just the way the guy was 30 days, or, you know, when you have to stand up for that sobriety countdown. I was at the International Conference of Young People in AA in New York City, and I had 5 months back, and they did the sobriety countdown, and, you know, it's overwhelming. There were thousands of people there, and but you feel, it's just a weird feeling. A part of you is really happy and joyous, and the other part wants to run away and never come back here again. Like what you had to read the traditions. I know that feeling, you know, like you want to do it. Egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. So that, whoever said that was a genius, the guy who said that first, because it describes this perfectly, you know. So there is a part of me wants to get up here and tell my story and you know, be at the front of the room, and then there's another part that wants to crawl under the thing and never be seen, and it's amazing for doctors with this disease. So anyway, I asked the counselor, what should I do? And she said, you know, I think you should go to bed next to your father. I said, that ain't happening. What else can I do? She said, you can try going to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went back to work, and I called George, Because I knew George went to AA, but George wasn't powerless over cocaine. So I was a district steward, and he was a steward under me. So naturally, I got George to be my first sponsor. I don't really know anything about what's going on, but I'm certainly, you know, I want to find out some information, but I was looking for Evan Wood's Speed AA Dynamics, you know. So he takes me to my first meeting in City Island in the Bronx on a Monday night, and the building was just what I wanted it to be. It was an old closed-down school. City Island in the Bronx is like a little marine community that's like separate from the Bronx. No one from City Island ever says they're from the Bronx. They're from City Island. Or Riverdale. Those sections are not considered the Bronx to those people who live there. But I'm here to tell you, it's the Bronx. So I went to the meeting, and, you know, leaky pipes and paint falling off the ceiling, and the building was just what I wanted to do, so I could, you know, take your inventory and get the heck out of here. But the people were nothing like I expected. You know, I believe it or not, I had no idea of what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I knew what rehab was. I thought the steps and the traditions were part of South Oak Hospital and I'm from Long Island. I had no idea that they were part of AA. I knew nothing about the program. But the people had the happy eyes. You know, there were sober people in the room. And that's what I wanted. You know, you can't hide that. If you're sober, it shows. And if you're not, it shows. And they knew I wasn't sober. But my friend John C, we had a lot of John C's at the old timers panel. My sponsor and closest friend in the world is John C from the Bronx. Sanitation John. John the garbage man. It's amazing how we don't know each other's last name, so we have to take each other's inventory. You know? Barbara, you know Barbara, which Barbara? You know Barbara, who was a prostitute? And she, oh, not Barbara! Bill, what's Bill? Bill has been 20 years of same thing for murder and his brother-in-law. Oh, God, we should know each other's last name, right? So, John was my hero. You know, he was like a famous bartender in Frog's Neck. He owned a couple of bars and he had a house with a swimming pool in the Bronx. A swimming pool in the Bronx. I thought this was like, you know, I saw him at the meeting, I'm like, oh, he must have had to take one of his customers here. It never dawned on me that a guy with that kind of success could be a member of AA. Well, you know, what was he doing there? He's a member of AA. He's a drunk like me. And he told me about this really crazy group of young people at the Never Too Young group. And he said it met over in the mental health center on Globe Avenue in the Bronx. I could use some mental health. It was an hour and a half meeting. A John's group, I spoke at his group's anniversary up here in John W. in Poughkeepsie. Really nice group, and I had the privilege of speaking at their anniversary, and you know, a lot of group policies with no soul saved after an hour or after 9 o'clock, you know. But the young people's group, because we talk a lot, they had an hour and a half meeting, and there were seven of the craziest people I ever met in the world. So I fit right in, you know. And I wish I could tell you that I did what that guy at the City Island meeting, I heard him say, there's five keys to sobriety. Don't drink, go to meetings, join a group, get a sponsor, and get active. And I've heard a lot of different variations of that. You know, some groups do get on your knees, and, you know, there's different variations. But that's the one I heard, the five keys to sobriety. And he said the most important key was getting active in the program and the fellowship. And I didn't do that. I did Alcoholics Anonymous my way, like many of us did. And the results were nil. Because I didn't let go absolutely. I didn't know how to do that. The only thing I did right was I stopped drinking, and eventually I heard that, you know, switching from alcohol to drugs and drugs to alcohol is like switching seats on the Titanic. And I heard these expressions, and you can't be high and sober at the same time. So I eventually fired George and, you know, stopped doing cocaine. I used to be at meetings where I talked really fast and grinded my teeth all the time. But I really started liking being at the meeting. You know how that happens? That metamorphosis takes place and you start liking being there. I had a lot of trouble with God because, you know, the God that of my understanding that I grew up with. My sister was a nun for 8 years. I was in a junior seminary for a year and a half myself. And I thought I was going to hell. If there was any truth to anything that I learned, I received everlasting fire. I had a third degree burn on my foot once. Everlasting fire. So I just abandoned God. You know, he didn't abandon me, but I just didn't want to deal with it. So I was dry and not sober, and Annette got pregnant. So I guess we had sex because she got pregnant. I was so emotional. If I had my life to be over again, I've said this many times to Annette, that first year, she probably would have liked to have been more, but that first year I would have moved out and went to the Y and lived somewhere else, not to have put her what I put her through, because I was pretty psycho crazy drinking. But you took the booze and the drugs away, man, now I was really a nut. And I was not a fun person to be around that first year. And she took all the brunt of it. So today I wish I could do it over, not to have caused her all the pain that I caused her. Because I never really wanted to do that. And I've never heard an alcoholic get up there and say that, you know, I was born and I couldn't wait to go out and screw everybody around and hurt everybody. And, you know, none of us ever had that intention. I never wanted to hurt people. But my disease took me down that course. So, let me see. There's that blank moment that we all have that you lose track of where the hell you are. Okay. What? She had a baby. So actually, she didn't have the baby. She got pregnant and she had a miscarriage. And now, I didn't realize that 20% of first pregnancies end up in a miscarriage. My mind went right to that punishing God that I grew up with. In my mind, I was like, you see, I try to do the right thing, and this is what I get. Here's a poor me again. And, you know, Annette was having a really hard time. And I wasn't drinking, but I stopped going to meetings. Because the one thing that I hadn't learned how to do was to come here and share pain. You know, James Cagney wouldn't come here and share pain with you guys, so why should I? You know, he was my idol before. You know, the tough guy, James Cagney, was my idol. And I never shared pain. I did all the other stuff. Ashtrays, beans, and coffee. I made tons of coffee. I had no problem with that, but I wouldn't tell you what was going on inside of me. So I had to stop going to meetings because I was devastated. I wasn't going to tell you that. And then I was 1 week away from my supposed first anniversary, and I got invited to a Lincoln's birthday party, February 12th, 1982. I got invited to, and I came to A February 20th, 1981. So I'm 8 days from my supposed first anniversary. I went to the Lincoln's birthday party at the American Legion Post in Frog's Neck, where the phone guys were having this party. And I'm telling you, when I left the house, consciously, I didn't say, you know, I'm going to go drink it tonight or anything. It was a slip waiting to happen, and all the ingredients were there, but I didn't consciously say, I'm going out drinking tonight. I asked Annette, you know, you want to come to the party? And she said, you know, no, I don't want to be around people yet, you know. She still don't like me. But she didn't want to come, but she said, yes, the magic words. Oh, you go. You've been good. Yes, I have. I think I'll saunter over to the party. And I didn't go by the bar. You know, there's a bar in the American Legion and a back room, like most of them, where they have the parties. And I went to the back where the food was, and I hung out there. And a guy got up that I used to hang with, and he just took a straw, and he put the straw to his nose, and he made what's the cocaine high sign for a lot of us. And I got up, and I went out to his Cherokee Jeep with another guy, and I snorted a few lines of cocaine. Just like that. Like I never came to AA. And I knew I was powerless over alcohol and drugs. And when I did it, it scared the hell out of me. I went back into the American Legion, and you ever get that feeling like everyone, like right now, you were looking at me? Well, I had that feeling just fear. I mean, my mind was racing like a million miles an hour, and I was looking at the bar and saying, well, you had a flip, you might as well go ahead and drink. But the fear and the thoughts that came through my head, you know, like, well, then you get drunk, and maybe you go home and do something real brilliant to Annette, and I was paralyzed with fear. I realized that I blew this whole program, and I really never had it in the first place. So I went home, and I confessed to Annette what I did. And I said, you know, I won't be able to celebrate next week. And she said, they can't do that to you. You didn't drink. She still loved me. But I tell her, no, it's not about that. I just have to start over. You know, I don't have this thing right. And I think for the first time in my life, I got some real humility in my life. I was really frightened that night. You know, a couple lines of cocaine for people who don't understand that is like a half a can of beer. It's not a lot, but it's just the fear was overwhelming. So I came back to a meeting, and I went to the toughest meeting that I knew of in the Bronx. It was a real strict alcohol group, old-timers, and we were to sit down, shut up, you don't know nothing about sobriety, old-timers, that I didn't respect at the time. I love now and wish I could have them in my hip pocket, you know, the other 23 hours of the day when we're not at a meeting. But, you know, I was a sick cat at the time. I took everybody's inventory. And I sat, it was interesting, because I sat at the meeting right at the first seat next to the speaker, hoping that I could go first and get it out. And interestingly enough, there was a nun leading the meeting that night, which had God's sense of humor working all the time in my life. And she didn't start to the right, she started to the left, so it went all the way around the room, and I had to go last. And I had this other sick thing going on that, like, I knew I was going to confess that I did cocaine, and that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is here for. And I think I wanted people to insult me or yell at me or say something to me so that I could leave AA and go on my merry way and get drunk and blame it on all of you guys. And the people that I had these resentments against were the people who came up to me after the meeting and hugged me and said, that took a lot of courage and were proud of you and welcome back and nothing to what I expected to happen in my head. And my life's never been the same. Since that time, I've taken all the suggestions that we have in our fellowship. I've had so many privileges and honors, it's hard to describe, but I'll try to do that in a short time. The next thing that happened was I got involved with the International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous, known as ICIPA in a lot of circles. It's a yearly convention that takes place somewhere in the United States and Canada every year. And at the time, coincidentally, John Sweeney, Sanitation John, went to Minnesota the year before. It was there. And when he came back, he said, hey, this ICIPA is coming to New York City. The 25th ICIPA, and it's going to be in the Big Apple, and you got to go to this thing. So I said, yeah, I'll go, you know. I invited him that, but he wanted to go, so but he said, you go. Well, this time I was going to a good place. And I went, and there's not much hugging going on in Bronx AA. You know? It's just, yeah, it's real good AA, but there's usually not a lot of hugging. And they stuck this badge on me, and this big black man named Ron, I grew up in the project, and this big black guy comes and he starts hugging me. And I'm like, oh my God, what's going on here? And I didn't say anything out loud because he was very big, and I'm not stupid. And he hugged me and he says, love you. He saw my bag and he says, love you, Jim. I go, okay. Walked away from him real quick. I went to a lot of meetings, and I was really enjoying the meetings. And I was honest by this point. You know, I was sharing what was going on. I raised my hand. I said, you know, this is a really awesome convention, and I'm having a good time. But I don't like this fuzzy crap. You know, they call the hugs fuzzies. And they'd have fuzzy jokes. They'd actually stop a meeting right in the middle of the meeting and have a fuzzy joke. And everybody would be hugging everybody. Yeah, pretty women were fine, but guys hugging me. That was not how I grew up. I don't remember ever my father hugging me in my whole life. I don't remember my mother hugging me in my whole life. And we just didn't do that. We did the, you know, the Irish peck on the cheek. I'm a, you know, I'm not touched too much. So what was happening was I was learning a whole new way of life, and I had to open my rock, concrete, hard brain and start opening up, letting the walls down, and it started happening. So ICIPA was my first adventure outside the group, and then I had a resentment. I became a general service representative, and I was going to come straighten out Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met this guy, Jimmy S., who was a delegate, past delegate, and a trustee for AA. He was a general service trustee, an in-town trustee, and a friend to the grapevine. And I had taken his inventory a few times at meetings, thinking that he was the enemy. And he turned out to be a very close friend of mine. He taught me what was really going on in service outside the group level. And it was interesting because there was like a liaison happening in our area between young people in AA and general service, because there was kind of a rift. That's a long story, I won't go into it. But anyway, I was able to kind of help bridge the gap. And we started a young people's conference in the Bronx called the Bridge Over Troubled Waters Conference of Young People in AA. So it's kind of floundering now. It might end, but that means God's done with it for now. But it lasted about 15 years, and a lot of people had a lot of opportunity to give service back to AA and come and have a nice weekend like we're doing here. And I just continued on in service. I was able to, I was kind of BCM, alternate chairman of the Bronx, and then chairman of the CUNY Convention, the 21st CUNY Convention. A lot of you have been there. I have a lot of friends in the room. Kind of nice. And then I became alternate delegate of the area, and then I was elected delegate for the Southeast New York area. And, you know, how that happened to a bunch from the Bronx was incredible to me. You know, I got to hang around with some really incredible people for 2 years. Now I'm a nerd. When I was growing up in the Bronx, my goal in life was not to become a nerd. But now I'm a Northeast Regional Delegate, and we have a nerd weekend every year. And they actually hand out their little nerd candies, and some people who are nerd t-shirts. Yeah. But I learned so much in that time. It's incredible. Back when I went to ICCPA, right after that year, I had my first anniversary was February 12, 1982, and 83 was my first anniversary. And at that meeting, I said, "Nothing's ever going to top this feeling. This is one of the greatest feelings I've ever had in my life." And I learned not to say stuff like that in AA, because a month later, my son was born, and I was there to witness it. And I assure you, if I was drinking, there's no way on earth I would have been in that hospital room with my wife. I would have been in the port side, handing out cigars, saying, "I think she's having the kid now." Drunk out of my mind. But instead, I was where I was supposed to be. My sponsor, by the way, was outside the hospital delivery room waiting for me in case I punked out. He was going to make me go back inside. Because anything new, I'm afraid of, and if there's going to be pain involved, I'd rather I'm the one that had it. You know, I've had broken bones and all the stuff that happened to us as drunks, and it never scared me so much when I got hurt. But when somebody that I cared about got hurt, I'm just no good in those situations. And during childbirth, there's some pain involved. In case you're not aware of that. And I made the very dumb mistake of leaning over to Annette and saying, "No pain, no gain." I thought it would be cool, but if she had it done, I wouldn't be here right now. But Jimmy was born in spite of me being in that room. And I mention it every time I speak because of one reason. When he was born, and everything was there, 10 fingers and 10 toes, and everything was where it was supposed to be, when she had the miscarriage, before Annette had the miscarriage, I was worried about things like, where am I going to get the money? How am I going to afford the kids? He's going to stop working. All these things that I shouldn't have been caring about instead of having a happy, healthy child. So, God knows exactly what he's doing. I was no more ready to be a father than the man in the moon at that time. So when I had a little sobriety under my belt and my sponsor was taking me through the steps, things happened when they were supposed to happen. So when Jimmy was born, I was a little more ready to be a father, I think. But what I'm getting at is, when he was born and everything was there, I had the most incredible high of my whole life without taking any alcohol or drugs. I mean, I was standing on my feet, but I was flying around that hospital room. And I've had those feelings in sobriety, and I've never been able to top them. Any drunk that I've ever thought of, even the good drunks that we have in the beginning of the fun, I've had experiences in AA that are beyond my wildest dreams. And when the guy said that at my first meeting, when you hear people say, "Things are going to happen beyond your wildest dreams," I wanted to puke on them when I was new. I said, "I'm never going to have another happy day as long as I live, you moron. I can't drink no more." You know? That's the way I thought. I had no idea of the life that was ahead of me. So I've had those experiences. I watched my son score his first hockey goal. You know, I love horses. I watched my daughter learn how to be an equestrian. You know, I did everything asked backwards. I learned everything by the seat of my pants or the hard way. I watched my daughter go take horseback riding lessons and learn how to ride a horse properly. You know, I tried to teach her for several years, and we fought like cats and dogs. She took a few lessons, she's riding like Roy Rogers. It's amazing. We're still dangerous, even children. I realize that now. But those moments, you know, I never would have had. Somebody said, you know, the chain is broken in my family. To the best of my knowledge, I'm the first one in the history of my whole family that was lucky enough to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now my children have a shot. I don't know how much of a shot, though, because everyone I hear, man, I got seven kids. Five of them are in the program. They never saw me drink. I'm like, oh, no. And now I got new stuff going on. Fear of financial insecurity is, you know, it says fear of financial insecurity reliever. It doesn't say financial insecurity reliever. Because, you know, my son is 17. He's going to be going to college, hopefully up here, and Hudson Mohawk trips here, so here. He wants to go to Siena, but I mean, he's doing all the things, right, Siena. He's doing all the things that I sat and dreamed about on the bar stool. You know what I mean? He's part of the team. I'm an assistant coach on the team. You know, I get the parts and stuff. I don't know what the hell's going on, but I'm participating in it, you know? I had many years in service, and I capped it off with 2 years of being a delegate, and now I'm a past delegate, and they keep you busy and see me, and they give you certain jobs to do, but it's not as hectic as when you're a delegate. I mean, just check out Craig's schedule sometime, your delegate. Find out how much you've got to be available for AA. I mean, it's a hectic time, but, you know, and there's good and bad and everything. There's some tough times being a delegate, too, but I don't think there's too many delegates that would ever trade that opportunity to serve the fellowship like that. It was an unbelievable experience. So, you know, now I've had several years of participating with my kids and my wife, which they're probably not too happy about. But it's an amazing journey, you know. The joy's in the journey, and I'm going to keep hanging around. My name's in the hat for trustee, and I'm praying that I don't get it. We did the election this month, you know, in the area to become a candidate, and then at the conference in April, they'll be the actual trustee, U.S. trustee at large. And I'm really saying that it's not God's will. And I get it. I was lucky enough to be in Minneapolis for the international convention, and I was lucky enough to have dinner with Jim Estelle. I can use his last name because he was a non-alcoholic chairman of the board of AA, and I got to spend some time with him at dinner, and I was really hurting about this decision. Like, I didn't think I was going to put my name in the hat. I didn't want to put my name in the hat, to be honest. And he said, aren't you qualified for that job? He's a really soft-spoken, wonderful guy. He's the warden, or actually probably a higher title than that, for all the prisons in Texas. And he came to love AA because he saw all these cons getting sober in AA, and it was miraculous to him. And he wound up giving many, many years of his life to service of AA, and he's not even a drunk, and you don't get paid for it. Kind of an amazing thing. But he told me, and I thought of all the time that he gave, so I don't really want to get elected, but I do have this motion past delegates that usually put their names in the hat, so I'm putting my name in the hat. You know, I talked it over with my family, and I told my job, and I'm praying like hell that it's not God's will for me to have, you know, the chances are less than average, because, you know, first you got to be elected in the area, and then there's like 50-something candidates in the United States, so there's a good, good chance that I ain't getting elected. But I'm putting my name in the hat because I'm sober. Because, you know, service gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, being here with you guys tonight is like a miracle. You know, I don't deserve this. I deserve to be drunk in a bar somewhere. And AA gave me this life. And I'm going to keep coming, and I want to thank you all for letting me be here tonight, and love you all.